Okay. I think we're close enough now. And so I'm going to start the word of the Buddha. So I did just it makes sense to me, just a very brief introduction to the third noble truth. So I'm just going to go over it from the beginning. The noble truth of the cessation of suffering. Can you hear okay? Good. This is the noble truth of the cessation of suffering. It is the remainderless fading away and cessation of that same wanting. Wanting related to the five senses, wanting for existence, and wanting not to be. The giving up and relinquishing of it. Freedom from it, never letting it settle enough to grow. And last time I just mentioned those four Pali words. That is Patinissaka, Chaga, Muti and Analiya. And the Patinissaka is literally like throwing things away. Chaga is like giving, expecting nothing back in return. And Muti is this idea of freedom. And I describe that as wherever you are, happy to be here. And lastly, Analiya, whatever occurs to you in life, just allowing it to be like your mind to be like a Teflon mind, nothing sticks to it. As soon as it settles, it disappears straight away. And then Buddha continues, wherever in the world there is anything agreeable and pleasurable, there the cessation of wanting comes about. And what is there in the world that is agreeable and pleasurable? Sight in the world is agreeable and pleasurable. Hearing, smell, taste, touch and knowing is agreeable and pleasurable. And there this wanting comes to be abandoned. There a cessation comes about. Can you see it okay? Whatever spiritual seekers in the past regarded pleasant and agreeable things in the world as impermanent, as suffering, as non-self, as an affliction, as fearful, they abandoned wanting. Now that's what we discussed last time, so I'm just going to continue on here. But with the remainderless fading away and cessation of that same wanting, tanha. Tanha, as you all know, means thirst. Often it's translated as craving. The idea of craving is just a bit too strong for wanting. Even small bits of wanting also are included in this second and third noble truth. With the fading away of that same wanting, comes cessation of fuel. This is dependent origination. The upadana literally means taking up. With the cessation of fuel, cessation of states of existence, with the cessation of states of existence, cessation of rebirth. Cessation of rebirth, aging and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, unhappiness and distress cease. Such is the cessation of this whole mass of suffering. This is the passing away of suffering. The cessation, subsiding and passing away of form, of experience, that's Vedana, of perception, of will, of consciousnesses, is the cessation of suffering. The subsiding of affliction, the passing away of aging and death. That's a powerful statement there. I'm not sure if last week or 2 weeks ago I emphasized that enough. I had to be careful in English. I never use the word stressed, because that's always got a bad implication. Emphasize has a good implication. So to emphasize the cessation, subsiding and passing away of form, of Vedana, of perception, of Sankhara, of consciousnesses, is the cessation of suffering. The subsiding of affliction, the passing away of aging and death. And now, very many people like to discuss Nibbana. And of course, in the suttas, as the Buddha described it, described two types of Nibbana. Nibbana with residue remaining. This is Satparisesa Nibbana. And Atparisesa Nibbana, without anything remaining. So the first of all, Nibbana with residue remaining. This is peaceful, this is sublime. That is the stilling. Samatha, of all will, sankhara, the relinquishing of all acquisitions, the destruction of wanting, fading away, cessation, nirvana. That's peaceful, sublime, when these things get so still that there's no will left. Relinquishing of all acquisition, destruction of wanting, fading away, cessation, nirvana. When excited by wanting, overcome by wanting, when full of aversion, overcome by aversion, when deluded, overcome by delusion, with mind obsessed by these, you intentionally create problems for yourself, for others, or for both. And you experience mental suffering and depression. But when wanting, aversion, and delusion are abandoned, you do not intentionally create any problems for yourself, for others, or for both. And you do not experience mental suffering and depression. It is in this way that Nibbana can be experienced directly. The destruction of wanting, the destruction of aversion, the destruction of delusion, this is called Nibbana, with residue remaining. So that's Nibbana with residue remaining. What do you really mean by that? When a person becomes fully enlightened, an arahat, a Buddha, then do they just disappear? They vanish? You say the defilements, the greed, hatred, delusion, wanting, all of that has been destroyed, but the five khandhas still continue on. That's a nirvana with the five khandhas remaining. And of course, there comes a time when that enlightened being passes away. When the Buddha experiences what they call parinibbana. And anyone who knows your Pali knows that pari means complete, full, total. It is nibbana with not just things like wanting disappearing, but also all the five khandhas disappearing. If one is intent on the end of wanting and clarity of mind, when one sees the arising of any of the six senses, one's mind is completely free from wanting. For one of peaceful mind, one completely liberated, there's nothing further to be done. No need to increase what has been done. As a stone mountain, one solid mass, is not stirred by the wind, so no sights, sounds, odors, tastes, touches, or mind objects, desirable or undesirable, stir the stability of the mind. The mind is steady and freed, and you witness the vanishing of the mind. That's a beautiful statement. It comes very clear in everything else which is said in a few moments. The vanishing of the mind. And one who has considered all the contrasts on this earth and is no more disturbed by anything whatever in this world, the peaceful one, freed from rage, from frustration and from wanting, the stream of consciousnesses will not be reborn. And this is again one of my favorite little passages about the bhikkhuni who was enlightened, called Wajira. And Mara, in this story from the suttas, comes up to Wajira and says to her, "By whom has this being been created? Where is the maker of this being? Where has this being arisen? And where does this being cease?" And the bhikkhuni arahat Wajira replied, "Why now do you assume a being, Mara? Is that your wrong view? This is a heap of sankharas. Here no being is found. Just as with a coming together of parts, the word vehicle is used, so when the five components of existence exist, there is the conventional term of being." And this is a powerful statement. "It is only dukkha, suffering that comes to be, dukkha that stands, and dukkha that falls away. Nothing but dukkha comes to be. Nothing but dukkha ceases. An arahat understands that the six senses, this is from the Samyutta, an arahat understands that the six senses, sight, hearing, smell, taste, touch, and the mind, will cease completely and totally without remainder, and no other senses would arise anywhere in any way. This is another way one knows that there is nothing more to be done for an arahat. That's one of the most clear and powerful statements of the wisdom of an arahat, and knowing that all the senses, the six senses, will totally cease and not arise anywhere in any way. And I left that to the end of the third noble truth, the end of suffering. Questions, comments, complaints? Yes.
Sometimes you have the mind consists of two parts. There is the knower and then the condition of the mind. When you say about this mind, which one are you referring to?
It's that difference is not recognized in Theravada Buddhism. We have the mind, and the mind is a sense which can know its own objects. It is the sixth sense, and it has no essential being which lasts forever. Please bear with us, because when we get into the next of these noble truths, the way leading to the cessation of suffering, and it goes into right view, you'll find that it's described quite clearly what the mind is and how we can get deluded about the nature of the mind. So can you bear with me with that question, and the answer will become much clearer in a few moments. If it doesn't become clearer, put up your hand again. Anyway, the noble truth of the way leading to the cessation of suffering, the fourth noble truth. There are two extremes that should be avoided: the pursuit of happiness through the five senses, and I'll just point out there, through the five senses. That is an accurate translation. It's explained later on in things like the Non-Conflict Sutta and Ranavibhanga Sutta. And it's very clear here, it's Kama Sukhali Kanu Yoga. And that always refers to the five senses. There's an interesting point there. There are these two extremes that should be avoided: the pursuit of happiness through the five senses, which is low, hina, secular, the way of worldlings, ignoble, unbeneficial. You see, I think we've got the same text here. When it says low, hina, that's where we get the word hinayana from. Hinayana is not an inferior vehicle, and it certainly should never describe anyone as practicing the Four Noble Truths or the Eightfold Path, Buddhists. Hina means low, despicable. It's actually quite a derogatory word. And I remember just, I still got the paperwork somewhere in my room, when I wrote to the Oxford English Dictionary to complain about them using the word Hinayana as an equivalent for Theravada. And we know, with all of the details from as many Pali and Sanskrit dictionaries as I could muster, to say that Hina is actually derogatory. And please excuse me, but it's like, you know, calling an African sort of a nigger. It's a very bad word. So if you look up in any dictionary the meaning of the word hina, you know, should never really be used. And actually they took it on board, which was great. And so now in the Oxford English Dictionary, if you get a reasonably modern one, not sort of 20 years old, you'll find there that it's said to be a derogatory word to be avoided. Anyway, and the pursuit of practices that fatigue the body and the mind. And I love that way of like fatigue calls tiredness, which is painful, ignoble, unbeneficial. Without going to either of these extremes, the Buddha has awakened to the middle way, which gives rise to vision, to wisdom, leads to peace, to direct understanding, to enlightenment, to nirvana. It is this noble eightfold path, right view, right motivation, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right endeavor, right mindfulness, and right stillness. Now, those of you who haven't heard me before can notice a few different translations you may have been used to before, because some of those old translations are not that accurate. Those old translations were started by Professor Rhys Davids over 100 years ago. And you know, he did amazingly well to get some of these very accurate. You know, like right, well, right view is pretty obvious. The right mindfulness came from him, and you got to give him more credit for that. When it comes to the second factor of the Eightfold Path, and it's called Sammasankappa, to talk to that about right thought or right intention, that both of those don't really fit. Intention is where you are aiming for. Thought is a hindrance to the path. It's not a part of the path. And so when it comes to the meaning of Sankappa, there are three explanations to Sammasankappa, and that is, it's like Nekama Sankappa, Avayapada Sankappa, and Ahimsaka Sankappa. And when you understand the meaning of those words, it's not what you're aiming for, it is where you're coming from. You're coming from actions of body, speech, and mind, which are coming from renunciation, coming from kindness, which is the meaning of Avayapada without hatred. The opposite meaning there in Pali does mean something positive, loving kindness and gentleness. That's why much prefer, and I can argue with you about it, that to have right motivation, where you're coming from. Speech, action, livelihood, fair enough. Samawayama, to call that right effort, again, makes no sense to me, simply because when you put forth effort in your meditation, you don't get any peace. You have to let go of the effort. As I've said to many monks in many talks, the effort stops when you get on your meditation cushion. When you let go of the will, you don't enhance the will. And then from that right endeavor, that's one of the translations. I'm still not settled on that, I must admit. Sometimes these days I prefer right restraint. Then right mindfulness, brilliant. And the last one, of course, you've heard me so many times, Samma Samadhi. To call that right concentration is just so counterproductive. If you try to make the mind still, you try and concentrate it, you get far too tense. But stillness is a much, much, much more effective, better translation of the word samadhi. That is the middle way awakened to by the Buddha, which gives rise to vision, to wisdom, leads to peace, to direct understanding, to enlightenment, nirvana. Okay, and here we go from the Rana Vibhanga, Majjhima 139. The pursuit of pleasure that is linked to the five senses, low, secular, coarse, ignoble, unbeneficial, is a state beset by suffering, frustration, despair, and fever. It is the wrong way. disengagement from the pursuit of pleasure that is linked to the five senses. Low, secular, coarse, ignoble, and unbeneficial, we're talking about the pleasures of the five senses there, is a state without suffering, frustration, despair, and fever. It is the right way. So instead of pursuit of the pleasure, the disengagement from the pursuit of pleasure, that is a state without suffering, frustration, despair, and fever. It is the right way. And this is one of the statements which I often state. This is from the Dhammapada. The Noble Eightfold Path is the best of all practices. Ezo wa mago nati anyo dasanasa visuddhiya. This is the only path for purifying insight. There is no other. Ezo wa mago nati anyo. I don't know any of you know Pali here, but that's so clear. This is the only path for purifying insight. There is no other. Follow this path and you will confuse Mara. And of course, the word I put up there, discombobulates. That's just Ajahn Brahm just having a bit of fun with the, one of my favorite English words. Listen, the end of dying has been reached. Now, sometimes people translate this, listen, the deathless has been reached. And straight away, if I translated it as the deathless, people start to think, oh, this is an amazing state, which is like beyond suffering, and but you still exist there somewhere. I'm just calling it, listen, the end of dying has been reached, which is a really good translation. It gives a totally different meaning, which is consistent with everything else which the Buddha has been teaching. Listen, the end of dying has been reached. I shall instruct you. I shall teach you the Dhamma. Practicing as you are instructed, by realizing for yourself in this very life, through direct understanding, you will soon enter upon and abide in that supreme goal of the holy life, for the sake of which people rightly go forth into monastic life. That's kind of the introduction to the Fourth Noble Truth. And then we go into the Eightfold Path. But before I go further, any questions which you have?
Ajahn, you mentioned that on that Samma Vayama, your translation, of course I think it's an improvement on the right effort. Would you say, I think in one of your Dhamma pieces, you used the word right outlook.
Outlook? Outlook. Not on Samavayama. It should be like right restraint. It's like a not doing rather than a doing. Yeah. Ability to restrain, to give up, to renounce, not to do. So it's an effort not to make effort.
It's the four sampapadana, isn't it? The four.
Yes, yeah.
Yes.
That's right, those four, which is about any unpleasant thing which is in the mind, to be able to know a way of, you know, getting rid of all unpleasant things. You don't get rid of unpleasant things through fighting them or not wanting them. Remember that simile of the monster who came into the empress's palace. Everyone tried to get rid of the monster, but every unkind act, unkind deed, unkind word, that monster grew an inch bigger. And more ugly, more smelly, more offensive. That's from the Yaka Samyutta. And so when the Empress came back, she said, she knew what to do. She said, welcome. Welcome, monster. Thank you for coming here. She used metta, loving kindness. And the monster just shrank inch by inch until one more act of kindness and the monster vanished completely away. That's how we get rid of things. You know, it should invade our mind. It's so beautiful kindness and renunciation, yes?
Sorry, Ajahn. If one's outlook is
generally on geared towards those four sampapadana, and it is grounded in things like metta, then that outlook will help mindfulness and the stillness.
Indeed, I think that what you're meaning there is that once you have the right view, when you have the right view, and you see there's nothing in here, you know what suffering is, and you know that the job of practice is to let go of that suffering, and so everything, all your sense activity stops, then that conditions the samasankhapa, the right motivation. You're motivated because of your right view. Once that motivation is pure, then your speech, action, livelihood also becomes pure. And once those things become pure, then the sense restraint comes even deeper in. Once that sense restraint comes in, then you find that you can practice satipatthana, your mindfulness increases in power. You've done what is called vinaya loke abhija dhammanasa. You've restrained the five hindrances. And once those things are restrained, your mindfulness increases to the point you can get stillness. In other words, the deep meditations of jhana. And from there, the understanding comes of liberation. So it's a restraint, and one thing leads to the other. So the outlook is more to do with right view. I don't know if it convinces you, but that's my answer.
No, that's a good answer, Ajahn. But what I thought was that in that sutta like Mahachatarisika Sutta, that it always says that right view and samadhi, samma vayama and samma sati, these three are always together.
Yes.
And that they are the ones that lead the other five factors.
I don't think you can really say that, and I think that's probably the bad translation. If I remember correctly, that in that sutta, I think in that sutta they do also say that there is a difference of alokya and aloka factors of the Eightfold Path.
Yes, they differentiate that sutta differentiates that.
And that doesn't make any sense at all, but it's also that differentiation only applies if you read that sutta to the first five factors of the Eightfold Path. There is no distinction at all between lokya and aloka for right sama vayama, sama sati, or sama samadhi.
It does say that, and towards the end of that sutta, it does say that.
It says there is no distinction. That
no distinction, yes.
Yeah, sorry?
It does say that it is the lokottara samadhi is the path of the factor. It says path factor.
But they don't have that distinction, lokuttara and loki, and what's the other one? And lokiya, for the last three factors of the path.
Yes, yes. So it does say that.
If you read that, that comes out quite strongly. And even the first part of it, there's many of us monks. We look at that distinction there and think that does really sound like an influence of later teachings into that particular sutta.
Yes. Yes, I think.
Because now how can you say that right view is even lokiya? Never can say that. And especially when you get to things like samadhi. Sama samadhi is always defined as four jhanas. And if ever you've experienced any one of those states, it's impossible to regard those as lokiya. You can never do that. How can you regard satipatthana as lokiya? It's not there. Okay, let's have another question. Okay, you got Eddie first and then Sue.
Ajahn Brahm, can you just scroll backwards just a little bit for right view? Can you do that?
I can't, but they can.
Oh, who can do it? Just a little bit. Sorry, then you can, if I tell you, yeah, a bit more, just a little bit. Okay. Okay, if you read here, okay, just here, disengage.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's the middle way.
Disengagement from the pursuit of pleasure.
Disengagement from the pursuit of pleasure that is linked to the five senses. Low, circular, coarse, ignoble, and unbeneficial. A state without suffering, frustration, despair, and fear, and it is the right way. So based on this thing, it's the extreme, you know. Where does the middle, earlier you said about the middle way.
Yes.
It's the middle way. And sometimes if they should be sticking to one, sometimes they say, oh, middle way is the avoiding the extremes.
Yes, and it's okay, those extremes.
Then, that's what I always think, you know. But then sometimes they say, oh, you know, pursuit of pleasure brings to suffering. But yes. That's the extreme.
No.
You see what I mean?
I see what you mean, but it's... What I'm saying is, or what the Buddha is also saying, I would maintain, is that where you put extremes, the Buddha says quite clearly where the middle way really is, and where he puts that middle way is disengagement from the pursuit of pleasure linked to the five senses. That is one of the extremes. If you disengage from the pursuit of pleasure that's linked to the five senses, you find that you pursue the pleasure linked to the sixth sense, the mind. That is the middle way.
Yeah, I know what you mean. But my version, sorry, of middle way is, if you tune the guitar string too much, it will snap. If you leave it too loose, it will play. That's what I always thought, you know.
Indeed.
Yeah.
But if you leave it too loose, and you don't know just the right amount to tighten it, which is no for a string, it's not making it snap, it's leaving it so loose, when something hits it, it doesn't make any sound at all. Because the job is not to make music, but to make peace. So this is how the Buddha is describing it. And that makes the most beautiful music you can experience with the senses. Which is the light of the mind. Okay, Sue. Okay. Yeah.
Does that then apply to anyone who becomes enlightened who doesn't die?
Correct.
Yeah. And then Parinibbana would be the disintegration of the final...
five khandhas, yeah. So that's when what people say death is. But sometimes that some people don't call it death for an enlightened being because it's more powerful than just death. It may look like death to other people, but to an enlightened being, it's just the cessation of things. And we prefer the cessation. We'll come across this simile later on here if we have enough time. It's a simile of the fire going out, the flame. You can't say the flame dies. It's not annihilated. The causes for the flame, the wood, the heat, just is all used up. So the flame just ceases. You never call it dying. Ceases. This is where good old Bill gets lots of exercise. He's in training for the next Olympics.
Ajahn Brahm, I'd like to ask, I recall reading a sutta where the Buddha was asked, he was talking about sitting in, a man was asking him about how it is to sit in the middle of the forest, that the rumble of the trees was frightening to that man. And the Buddha says, no, the sound is thrilling. Doesn't that also sound a bit like enjoying pleasure of nature or the enjoying, like, you know, you with the ocean surf or a little bit like that?
Yeah. The Buddha said it could be thrilling because sometimes people just like the excitement. That's one of the reasons why they go bungee jumping, they go on fast motorbikes. But again, the best, he also said, unless you know that stillness of the mind, people who go into the forest go mad. They go crazy. But if you can let that sound disappear and go, that's real stillness, not the sound of silence. No sound left at all. Real stillness. Those five senses vanish. Then that is always the best. It's not thrilling. It's satisfying.
Here it says, you witness vanishing of the mind.
Oh, good. I'm glad you noticed that one. Yes.
Is that Nirodha Samapatti or something like that?
Yes, something like that. I don't know exactly remember what it really is, but that's I think it's like, when I said the mind, it must be the jitta vanishing. Okay. One right view. This one is brilliant. How to know right view from wrong view. This is what the Buddha said. After my parinibbana, complete cessation, some will think that the Dharma has ended and you no longer have a teacher. This is wrong. After the Buddha's parinibbana, the Dharma and Vinaya will be your teacher. So you don't just need a Buddha to instruct you, you have the Dhamma and Vinaya. And that's a very powerful statement. It meant the Buddha did not have to select someone to succeed him. Like when a Pope dies, you have to select the next Pope. A Dalai Lama dies, you have to select another Dalai Lama. And so that lineage of hierarchy and control continues on. But he said, no, after I pass away, what I've taught, the Dhamma and the Vinaya, that will be your teacher. And that's one of the reasons why in Buddhism we don't have a leader in the sense of a person. We have the Dhamma Vinaya. Now, this is also the four great standards is what comes next. Suppose someone were to say, friends, this is the Buddha's teaching, the Dhamma and the Vinaya that I heard myself from the Buddha. Then you should check these persons' words with the Sutta and the Vinaya. If they agree, then you should conclude that this is the teaching of the Buddha. If it disagrees with the Sutta and Vinaya, you should conclude that this person has wrongly understood the teaching of the Buddha. You don't say the person is wrong, you say they've wrongly understood it. It's not a personal sort of complaint, it's just they need to learn it a bit deeper. Or suppose someone were to say, friends, I heard this from a community of senior monastics with distinguished teachers. Then you should check this person's word with the Sutta and Vinaya. If they agree, then you should conclude that it is the teaching of the Buddha. If it disagrees with the Sutta and Vinaya, then you should conclude that this community has wrongly understood the teaching of the Buddha. The whole community. Or suppose someone were to say, friends, I heard this from many learned elders who uphold a tradition, forest tradition, another tradition, the Siam Nikaya, or the forest monks of Burma. I heard this from many learned elders who uphold a tradition. Then you should check this person's words with the suttas and the Vinaya. If they agree, then you should conclude that this is the teaching of the Buddha. If it disagrees with the Sutta and Vinaya, then you should conclude that these elders have wrongly understood the teaching of the Buddha. Or suppose someone were to say, friends, I heard this from one learned elder. Then you should check this person's word with the Sutta and Vinaya. If they agree, then you should conclude that it is the teaching of the Buddha. If it disagrees with the Sutta and Vinaya, then you should conclude that this learned elder has wrongly understood the teaching of the Buddha. So the Buddha mentioned that just to make sure the final authority is not some learned monk or nun or authority or professor at university or a whole group of monks or professors or nuns, but the final authority always has to be the sutta and the Vinaya. And that's why we teach this. Yes, go on.
Ajahn, at that time, since it was the Mahasangha monastics who held the Vinaya and the Sutta, no, I mean, it was not written anywhere, it was not on internet or anything, you know, it was just word, you know, mouth to mouth.
Yeah.
And therefore, I'm a bit surprised why the Buddha didn't mention the Mahasangha as the representative or the carrier or the courier, something like that.
Indeed, because even in the time of the Buddha, some members of the Sangha had some really strange views. So he wanted to make sure that the Dhamma and the Vinaya was going to be more powerful than any other monk or nun.
Yes, but how do you access it?
How you access it? Because we do have this large collection of suttas, and also the Vinaya, the training, because even in the Vinaya there's some amazing suttas and amazing teachings in there.
Yeah, that is now, but I'm talking about that time.
Yeah, but what it is, it became the repository for the teachings, and those are to be trusted, because other monks might come up, and they may have great ideas. And I say that what we see in today's suttas is not the authentic suttas, that they have been changed in this way or that way. And even today, many people wonder, how do we know that those suttas and Vinaya, which we have in our libraries, which we have online now, how do we know that that's actually what the Buddha taught? And that's one of the reasons why Ajahn Bhumali and who else was involved in this?
Sujata
did this wonderful project called the Authenticity Project. And I really encouraged him with this, and I tried to give as much support and influence as I possibly could. How do we know that what's actually in those suttas is authentic? And there's a lot of very powerful arguments to say that these can be supported with all those arguments. These are pretty authentic. One of the arguments is that if you read these suttas in many different recensions, even from different traditions, you find there is part, well, the most of it, 80-90%, is always repeating the same things. There is a consistency of the message there of even many traditions. And that consistency of the message and so many different versions of that same sutta also coinciding gives the sense of some things in the Buddha's teachings, you know, like Four Noble Truths, Eightfold Path, meditation. Those parts of it are consistent, and they come across so many times in the suttas, page after page after page. The repetition gives it more of a sense of authenticity.
Thank you, Ajahn.
So that means the suttas and the Vinaya, you can pretty much look at those as an authentic, powerful, consistent document of the word of the Buddha. Yeah, go on.
In the last section when we're covering the Yamaka Sutta,
yeah.
It was one of the examples where you're using the translation of the word Sankara as will as well. And so I just wanted to ask you to comment a bit. Is that okay? Just to digress a little bit. In a lot of descriptions of sankhara I've seen, there are lots of different components of it, and one of them is will, chanda, that's you. So there's adimokkha, which is kind of decision, which is kind of similar. Like if you're driving Chaitanya. A car, there's going to be, you know, there's going to be willpower is going to kick in, but it's going to relax. So it's sometimes there and sometimes not. But you're using it as like a global translation for all of sankhara. But it seems to include things like jealousy or desire or metta, or lots of things can be within sankhara, only one of which seems to have this willpower part.
No, I'm just looking for the reason why I translate it as will. And I must admit, I always like the idea of calling it will, but the inner suttas, where has it gone? Sankhara, he calls it Chaitanakaya. The body of Chaitana, not Chanda, as will. Yeah. Will, Chaitana.
Intention is only one aspect, isn't it? You've got attention, intention, willpower, decision. They're all under Chaitana. Sankhara.
Yeah, but Chaitana, that is another form of will.
But it's only one small component of sankhara.
Oh no, that's the main thing. That's why I'm trying to find that translation for you. The definition of it. Sankhara. What is the sankhara component of existence? The definition of sankhara is the six types of will. Chaitana Kaya. We involve with the objects of the six senses. When you call it Chaitana, Chaitana is very much the word will. Which is why even in dependent origination, the word Sankhara is usually defined as the volitional activities, volition, will. Yeah?
Ajahn, that on the previous topic, that authenticity of the, if I may ask you that somewhere, I think it was Great Arahant Venerable Sariputta who mentioned that the whole Dhamma can be put into the Four Noble Truths.
Yeah.
So would you say if anyone's teaching is outside the Four Noble Truths, then we can say it is not the authenticity?
You can say that, but you can, you know, take it even further and find out what they say. Is there anything in that which you can find in the suttas or the Vinaya? Anything which you can support it? And at this point, you know, I will invoke just words of advice, which I got, which I've told you many times before, from Venerable Nyanaponika, before he passed away. And he said, you should never interpret the whole mass of repeated teachings in the suttas and Vinaya. To reinterpret that in line with one or two ambiguous passages in the Sutta or the Vinaya. You should always interpret the ambiguous passages in light of the clear multiple passages. Because sometimes, you know, we have, especially what we call poetry over in Pali. And poetry, if ever you try to translate Pali, always uses some weird forms. And I often just quote things like, you know, William Wordsworth, I wandered lonely as a cloud, which if you read that as verbatim, means that he could levitate. And of course he never meant that. You were just trying to create a feeling, an emotion, an inspiration, a And some of the words which you use in the verses, you know, sometimes if you want to try and make those specific, instead of inspiration, what's the word when, I forget the language now, when you want to make these like specific instructions or specific descriptions, rather than something to evoke inspiring emotions. Sometimes you can interpret some of the Buddha's teachings in a totally new way. A good example of that is, you know, you got, just comes to my mind, one of the causes for being a stream winner is paratogosa, the words of another. And I remember just one person read that and said, oh yeah, of course that's right. You need the words of God, you know, to be able to inspire you and hear the sweet sound of Jesus or something. And so they can have a word like that, which is a real word, paratogosa, but don't realize that that is very well explained as the words of another Aryan. Go on.
The most unambiguous part is the Four Noble Truths.
Yes.
So if I think it is in the Maha Hattipadopama Sutta.
Yeah, good.
There that you can put the whole Dhamma into
the
Four Noble Truths. So if it agrees with Four Noble Truths, then
it's pretty good, yeah.
Is that related to the, they say two ways, one is Satpat, one is Vipassana, one is Samatha. Are you trying to
those two differences, they're just not valid. There's not two ways to enlightenment, go samatha or vipassana. Sometimes you may say that there's those two ways to become a stream winner, but once you become a stream winner, one is strong, the other one is weak, they both have to be there. But from being a stream winner to being fully enlightened, that is where you have the whole Eightfold Path. You can't just have insight without the stillness.
Thank you, Ajahn Brahm.
And if those of you who haven't heard it before, I'll finish off here because it's been a lovely session, but we've gone over and backwards and forwards. Those are the simile of the two messengers. And those two messengers, even though the Buddha, I just mentioned it in a sutta, and it's fully explained in another place, about the king who had a son, he wanted to teach him how to be a good emperor when the king died. So he sent his son off to a bordering kingdom, gave him full authority there, so he could learn, you know, on the job of how to rule a little kingdom. And of course, after about 6 months, the headman of that region sent a delegation to the emperor saying, your son is just partying all the time. He's not doing any ruling, it's not working. So the emperor sent a wise minister to teach his son how to rule. And as soon as the wise minister came to see the king's son, the son said, no, go away, this is my territory. I'm not listening to you, but I come from your father, the emperor. I don't care who you come from, get out. And so the wise minister had to go back and report to the emperor, your son's not even listening to me. And the emperor said, oh, I made a mistake. So he sent the emperor next time together with one of his fiercest generals from the army. So the two went together, the general and the wise minister. When they arrived at this region, the prince, you know, the king's son, saw the minister and said, look, I already told you to get out of here. I'm not listening to you. This is my region. And at that, the general went right up to the son, put the sword to his throat and said, I've also been sent by your father. Listen. And with a sword at your throat, it's amazing how much you're listening. And said, yes, I'm listening, I'm listening, I'm listening. And then the wise minister was able to instruct the son about the pleasures and also the duties of leadership. And then the son became a good little prince and eventually took over the whole empire. And in that simile, the Buddha said those two messengers were insight and stillness. stillness will hold you still so you can see clearly and know accurately what's actually going on. You're not just seeing what you want to see. So that's the Buddha simile there. There's no such thing as vipassana without samatha, or samatha without vipassana. You do need both of them. Oh, he was the next senator. Yes?
You say that parinibbana, the lower seas, and transform into luminous, boundless, silence?
No. I would say that when the five khandhas cease, that being ceases. The process ceases. Nothing gets annihilated, but there's nothing left. So now we can pay respects to the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, and then we can go. It's almost, 4:30 already. Goodness.
Arahaṃ sammasambuddho bhagavā buddhaṃ bhagavantaṃ abhivādhemi suvakkato bhagavata dhammo dhammaṃ namassāmi suppatipanno bhagavato sāvaka-saṅgho saṅghaṃ namāmi.